Hello and welcome to another exciting and jam-packed season finale of Modern Day Philosophers. This is the season finale of season 4. I'm very excited to be here. I'm excited to be at this point with the show. Robert Klein is the guest. If you don't know who Robert Klein is, give him a quick Google. He's very, very important in terms of the history and socially important in the world of stand-up comedy and a very funny guy. And I can't wait to share that with you. First, of course, I have to tell you about our new sponsor. Our new sponsor is Ting. You go to ting.com to check out their website. Ting is a revolutionary new mobile service. I like the fact that they call it revolutionary because there's like a little revolution going on in there. But anyway, they launched in 2012. They run on the nationwide Sprint network, which means they're using the same cell phone towers as Sprint, but they're doing it in such a way that they're saving 98% of people a lot of money on their cell phone bill. They're doing cell phone contracts in a fair way. You're only paying for what you use. And if you have an ETF to come over to Ting, they're going to give you 25% back in Ting credit, which is pretty cool too. So really, you're just paying for what you use. And how it breaks down in minutes, you don't use any minutes, it doesn't cost you anything. You use 100 minutes a month, it's $3. It's 1 to 100 minutes a month, and so on. And then you pay separately for messages, similar rates, you know, messages, 1 to 100 messages a month, $3. And megabytes, 1 to 100 megabytes a month, $3. So if you did that, you'd have a $9 bill. But the average bill that they're saying people are having is only $21 a month, which is still way lower, way lower than most people are paying for their cell phone. So this is a really great way to save money, and you're getting great service. They've got customer service, by the way, with real people on the line. You don't have to talk to any robots. And you can bring over your phone. So you don't even need to buy a new phone. If you have a Sprint device, you can bring it over. If not, you can buy a phone off their website. And it's great. You don't have to pay for any hidden fees. An average phone company, by the way, if you join them, they say, oh, we'll give you a free phone. It's not free. You're paying for that phone every month with your phone bill. They're adding it into your bill. So you're paying for all sorts of shit that you don't need. It's a waste of money. This Ting.com is a very good thing. You want to see how much money you'll save? They make it very practical. You can go to Ting.com/calculator, put in your bill, and they'll tell you exactly what you'll save. So it's you don't have to worry or wonder or, you know, put in a few bills from a few months and do an average. You'll see what you can save, and it's pretty impressive. I have a promo code here. If you go to mdp.ting.com, that's MDP for Modern Day Philosophers, mdp.ting.com, you're going to get $25 off any new device that you buy, or if you don't want to buy a device, you bring over your old Sprint phone, you get $25 in service credit. So go to ting.com, check out their savings calculator, and you'll see how much money you're going to save. It's a great, great service. It's practical. Why should you be paying for anything you don't use? In general, it doesn't make sense that you would. So I'm pretty excited to have Ting on board. Go check out ting.com and use the promo code mdp.ting.com. Now, Robert Klein on the show. We recorded this at Robert's place within an hour of the news of Joan Rivers' death breaking. So as you can imagine, it was kind of a somber mood that I walked into. When I got there, he was like, do we have to do the philosophy? He didn't really want to do the philosophy, and I had to really kind of push it on him, and I leave that in the interview, me being pushy with the philosophy, because as I suspected, once he got into it, he had some brilliant things to say, but he was very hesitant to get into it. We talk about Rousseau. One thing we didn't get into about Rousseau, which I think is interesting, and it'll be even more interesting to you after you hear the episode, is that he was also a successful composer of music, and he wrote 7 operas, which may be a good thing that we didn't get into it. Once you hear Robert's connection to the opera, it might have took the interview back into a somber tone. But he also wrote music in other forms, and he made contributions to music as a theorist. During the period of the Revolution, the French Revolution, that is, Rousseau was the most popular of the philosophes amongst members of Jacobin Club. Jacobin Club was a big deal in France during the French Revolution. It was a society of the Friends of the Constitution there. It was the most famous and influential political club in the development of the French Revolution. There were at least 7,000 chapters throughout France, with a membership estimated at 500,000 or more. See, from a stand-up comic point of view, anything with 7,000 chapters, if you could do the tour, that's a pretty solid tour. So for the fact that Rousseau was the most popular there, that'll give you some perspective of just how important Rousseau was during his time. Rousseau was interred as a national hero in the Pantheon in Paris in 1794, 16 years after his death, which is pretty cool. But as I put it in perspective, it's also kind of sad because I'm thinking this week George Carlin got a street named after him in Manhattan, which is awesome, and I can't wait to take a picture with the sign there and everything, but I think, wouldn't it have been so much better if they would have done it during his lifetime? Why do we celebrate everybody after they're dead? It makes no sense. Make people feel important while they're still alive. Support the artist or the philosopher or whoever it is and show your appreciation, which, by the way, brings me to the fact that I am looking for some donations, folks. If you go to moderndayphilosophers.net, you can make a donation, and if you make a donation of $20 or more, I will send you, as a thank you, some Tweaked Audio earbuds, compliments of the people at tweakedaudio.com. It's the end of the season, guys. It's a good time to donate. And as you know, like they say on PBS or NPR, this programming would not be possible if not for the support of listeners like you. And I'm also going to add "and you" to the end of that, because why should it just be people like you? It should be you. It should be you. This program is also made possible by this next sponsor, who you've heard from before, the good folks over at Stand Up Records. Take a listen to this.
Warning. Last year, over 40,000 Americans died in car-related accidents. Not a pleasant thought, is it? In fact, as thoughts go, it's downright depressing. Well, that's where we can help cheer you up. We're StandUpRecords.com, and we offer the finest in CDs, DVDs, downloads, and merchandise from the best comedians on Earth. Artists like Marc Maron, Maria Bamford, Eddie Pepitone, and Doug Stanhope. Available at fine record stores, Amazon.com, and the iTunes Music Store. That's StandUpRecords.com. Come on, listen to us while you're driving. Live dangerously.
Go check them out. Stand Up Records. Pick up some comedy CDs. Pick up my CD. Some Kind of Comedian, Danny LaBelle, available right there at standuprecords.com. Okay, without further ado, except for the intro song, here's my talk with the fantastic and phenomenal, the one and only, Mr. Robert Klein. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny LaBelle, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny LaBelle!
Modern Day Philosophers.
One, two. How now, brown cow? Ah, sweet. Mercutio is dead. Is that good?
Is he dead?
Yes. Romeo and Juliet.
I know. I was just playing along. How you doing? How you feeling today?
No comment.
You're a tough interview.
I'm getting personal, man. How am I feeling today? It's like in New Jersey when a boxer, in the boxing ring, when they think there's concussion, the doctor comes up. He says, "What state are you in?" He's supposed to say New Jersey. Mm-hmm. "What state are you in? You mean happy? Sad? I don't know. You know, melancholy? That's it. Fight over." All right, go ahead. I have a poker game to play.
Do you play a lot of poker?
No, once a month. An old game with some pretty good guys, mostly older guys.
Are they comics also?
No.
Do you hang out with other comics?
No. I spent an intense 11 years with Rodney Dangerfield at the beginning of his career. I know comedians. I empathize with them, admire them. We're fellow troopers. But I never moved to L.A., and I'm just not sort of in the community, you know? I just have lots of friends, but they're not necessarily in show business. Although I love show business, and it's the perfect business for me, and it's much maligned, and it's much more of a meritocracy than people think. If you don't have the goods, you know, you gotta have something to make it in show business. It's not really who you know. You know, if you're a lousy actor, you don't get work. You know?
Do you think it's you got burned out by all those years with Rodney? Burned out on hanging out with other comics?
No. I just, I don't hang out. I 25 years ago, I moved out of the city. Mm-hmm. About 11 years ago, I took an apartment, so I have both. But I'm really, you know, I'm, I guess, suburban. I live in Briarcliff Manor. It's a, I have a beautiful view of the Hudson and a couple of acres. It's very close to the city, but I'm really not, you know, I go to parties, I go to some openings. I'm not a recluse, but I'm not, you know, I like my own company a lot, and I have, you know, a few friends that I've, some of whom I know for since I'm 12 years old. So, you know, I just, I was born and raised in the Bronx. I lived in the city all my life, and I always wanted a little land. I always wanted to be close to New York. I've never relocated to L.A. I've kept a place there briefly. But I never moved there, and I've had to rent houses doing things, and I never want to do that again. I just don't. I don't mind Los Angeles. I rather admire it because, by coincidence, I was there for both earthquakes in the 20th century, 71 and 94, working. Flip Wilson show and then shooting Sisters at Warner Brothers. And I really admire the courage of people there and all that, but I just, it's a strange place to me. I don't feel at home there. I feel at home in the East. I'm an Easterner, you know.
I understand that. As soon as I got back here, I felt that home feeling. But I have a much better quality of life living out there than I did here.
Because well, that's great. So you're expensive. Young and all that. Yeah. Say nobody, you know.
But I know
I
what
had
you
great
mean.
Times there. I you know, I first went there when I was 25 years old. I always dreamed of going there. And I've had to go there a million times in my career. But I've traveled enough, and I've stayed in enough strange beds and hotels and whatever. I love my home, and I love my apartment, and you know. So I've just done some work in the last year or so, a number of shows in Brooklyn. Good Wife, Royal Pains, and now Madam Secretary, which is coming out on CBS shortly with Taya Leone, you know, sort of like a gorgeous Hillary Clinton. It's so much fun, you know? I mean, I love working here. I've shot a lot of movies here, too. But I was the mayor in Sharknado. Of course, that was dangerous. Flying sharks, we got paid a little extra. I don't know how they made them play, but there they were. All over New York, flying. It was amazing, the stunt proportions of that. Getting dead sharks and dropping them from the Empire State. I don't know how they did it.
I worked with sharks for a little while. I worked in an aquarium in Israel, and I begged them to let me work with the sharks. They had a shark tank, and they had whenever a shark would get injured by...
Danny, what, are you crazy? No, how could we say that? Don't go in the shark tank. No. Unless the shark is Jewish. If the shark is Jewish, call me Sailor. But if it's a Goyish shark...
These are Egyptian shark, Robert. The crazy shark. They don't like the Jewish.
They don't like Egyptian...
My friend married an Egyptian Jew.
Yeah?
Yeah, imagine that. Go ahead. Next question.
I feel like
next
I should address
modern-day philosophers.
This somber thing that happened today. Maybe
Joan Rivers?
Joan Rivers passing away.
Yeah, I'd rather not talk about it. I know her for 40-some-odd years. She was an incredibly dynamic for her age. I hope, sincerely, that this clinic... It's my telephone. Could I have that? Hello? Hello? Oh, Debbie, you caught me at a really bad time. I'm actually on a podcast at the moment. Can I call you back? Yeah, no, he's not live, but in the middle of the taping. Joan Rivers? Yeah, I know about him. I'm the only comedian left, Debbie. They're all done. I am. I'll call you back. I got people here. All right, bye. Thanks. You know,
It was Joan Rivers that I saw at the Improv with her husband, Edgar, who was a very nice man. He was a Jewish South African with an English accent. Rodney once did a nice roasting statement of them. They walked into the Improv. He said, "I'll tell you, here they are, a nervous chayeta with a fraud Englishman for a husband." You know, a nervous chayeta. Where he got that, I don't know. That's the first time I saw a tape recorder being used by a comedian. One of my first visits to the Improv, not the first, but near the first, and I was in a Broadway show, Apple Tree, my first Broadway show, and I heard about the Improv, and I went from 44th Street to the Schubert Theater, down 44th Street, 9th to the Improv, and that's where, you know, eventually I met Bette Midler, came in, Danny Aiello was the bouncer, that's where I met Rodney. And Joan, too. And, you know, she's really a trooper, and she could be very, very funny. But she had a little stint with Second City, as I did. I didn't realize she's that much old, 9 years older than I. But she could be very cruel, and really cruel, like doing a dialogue of a stroke between Dick Clark and Kirk Douglas. That's awful, mm-hmm. You know, really awful. It's like a sick joke. It's cruel, and she could be cruel. She was very cruel to Elizabeth Taylor, but she carved out. Her husband committed suicide. She actually played herself, and her daughter played herself in a TV movie. She was a shameless, self-promoter and a very, very wealthy woman who. Lived them. I once saw her in this private club in the Sherry Netherlands, surrounded by these, international billionaires and all that. I mean, she accomplished a lot. I don't know what she did to her face and all that. And I hope that this accident did not occur on account of some more plastic surgery. It was an endoscopy clinic, they said, but, that's her business. And I'm sorry that she's dead. She was not my favorite. But the hard edge and the cursing to see a woman who, you could say she has balls, she's not afraid. People admire that, even if they're cruel or profane. I also worked with her a few times. We were on a double bill together. We also did a movie together. It's one of my routines. I stopped Joan Rivers in a movie. I made love to Joan Rivers in a movie. For the orgasm, we brought in a stuntman from California. And the rigging itself took 5 or 6 days. And she's a brilliant, multitasker, because while she was making love to me, she sold me 4 bracelets. If your girlfriend likes jade, this is jade. I guess that bit will have to be parked for a while. People will be very sad. Yeah. it is shocking. Not quite as shocking as Robin. It was a tragic, very nice man and a really great talent. You look from the outside, even his wife was surprised. He had periods of depression. He had a marvelous career. It wasn't as great as it once was, but it's neither is mine and no one's is. The greatest stars in the world. You have a kind of different level, but he's beloved. It was worldwide news. And so it's a puzzlement. And he was not chronically depressed as far as I knew, but ever since his heart operation, they say there's a 40% chance you get depression. Although he went back on tour, extremely sad. And I just, it crosses my mind the pain he had to be in,
Have you suffered depression yourself?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But the worst depression I ever had was when I was getting divorced. But that's because she kept on, 2 years worth of papers and lawyers and aggravation and a couple of ulcers. That's situational depression. But I think that I've had a touch of a very shallow kind of depression from time to time for long periods. And I take a minimum dose of generic Prozac, costs 18 cents a pill. And I am one of those people that it just like would trigger. I did it 20 years ago and I should have had a hint then that it worked. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't drink. I was drinking to excess, I thought. You know, it never interfered with anything, but maybe I just, it was sluggish, and I wanted it too much. And, you know, like over a bottle of wine, you know, and wine, of course, you know. Wine is alcohol.
Wine's tricky.
I can have a little bit of wine now and again, a glass of champagne New Year's. I've increased the glue sniffing and the PCP. And pot, oh my God, if they legalize that, what if kids got a hold of it? It should never be classified with the others. It's merely a cultural thing. The fact that all these straights, millionaires and Republicans and people everywhere, that their kin are hooked on pharmaceutical drugs that are as powerful as heroin, that's okay because that's a pill and it's manufactured by a man. But the fact you're smoking weed, which you could grow in your backyard in a second, and no one ever killed anybody on pot. I've had my fair share of drugs in my life, and the wonderful 60s, 70s, 80s, let me tell you something. I can't think of any as I've ever had as profound as alcohol. It can make you stupid, make you dangerous. And, you know, and it's a wonderful feeling if you know how to control it. There's no doubt. My father would have benefited from a couple of martinis every night. You know, he was so uptight. And
what did he do, your dad?
He was a textile salesman in the garment center here a heavy briefcase, mostly cotton goods to, you know, Ship and Shore Blouse Company, whatever. Made 2% commission. He made enough to send me to college, to send my sister and me to camp, to, you know, all kinds of nice things, but never any money. There's no money in my
house. Were you close with your folks?
Absolutely. I went off, and my sister survives. She's 4.5 years older. Went totally different ways. She wanted to be a teacher from the time she could first think, and she became a teacher. She taught for 33 years in New York. And I wanted to be a doctor, and that was all the guys. I was always a clown and this and that, but I never really thought realistically of being in show business until I saw live comedy in the Catskills when I was a kid or a busboy.
Was it the person you saw? Was it somebody I would know back then?
No. There were guys like Larry Deutsch, Bernie Burns, Lou Menchel. They were top, not stars, no television exposure, but they played the modest size hotels and bungalow colonies and got, you know, in 1956, you know, maybe $300-$400 for the show. And they go on doing, they do three in a night. You know, it's a lot of money. And I thought that their mission, coming in their Cadillac and getting out and making people hysterical for 35 minutes was great. But anyway, my parents, I did leave home when I was 16 to go to college, and I really never came back. I had to be there a few months after graduate school, and then they retired to Florida. But I was always close, but I, in a very healthy way, wanted to break off. I had no room in the Bronx. It was a one-bedroom apartment for four of us, one bathroom, which is why I read the New York Times cover to cover every morning on the toilet, which takes about 18 hours. So I'm 18 hours. My first 18 hours of every day are spent reading the New York Times.
Well spent time.
And I don't know why I have these, what do you call them, hemorrhoids, but any career needs luck. Go ahead, ask me what you want to ask me.
Well, I was just thinking that it's kind of interesting that your sister became a teacher, and I've always sort of seen you as a kind of a professorial figure as a comic.
I was a substitute for 8 or 9 months. My earliest routines on The Tonight Show, which I first did in January 19th, 1968, my early material was about substitute teaching. I felt I wanted to do, I loved these guys with the cufflinks. I'll tell you, my girlfriend's so fat, when she hangs around the house, she hangs around the house, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And they're funny, and the jokes are funny, and then everything doesn't have to be deep and intellectual. But I was very impressed by Lenny Bruce, who I never saw in person, but the albums, and Jonathan Winters, who was totally apolitical, and I just spoke at his memorial last year.
He was one of my favorites.
He was a genius. And I saw that stand-up comedy could be more than a guy in a tuxedo with cufflinks. So I wanted to make people think, and I also wanted to make them laugh, because that's what a comedian does. If you're not making them laugh, you're not a comedian. That was my objection to Andy Kaufman. He was really very innovative and imaginative, but he'd go on with a joke for 7 minutes reading Proust until people screamed at him. You know, that's performance art.
Right.
That's not...
I don't think he called himself a comedian, though.
Maybe he didn't. Anyway, hello, I'm in heaven, Andy. He was always normal with me.
Really?
Yeah, Rodney Swirl. I tell you, he really thinks he's Tony Clifton. I'm telling you, man. This cocksucker thinks he's Tony... I spoke to his best friend, that guy. What's his name?
Zamuda.
He said, no way. When I met him at the Improv, he was respectful and he wasn't weird. Elmo was weird. Emo Phillips, sure. I saw him work. I thought it was very good. I wanted to tell him he's out on 44th Street hiding behind a lamppost. I mean,
you know, I've interviewed him a few times, and he'll never just give me an interview as out of character. Emo.
Oh. And he also, what's her name, with the accordion. I liked her. And they actually went together. What would she see in him? Maybe he knew accordion maintenance. I think there's some method to madness. He knew how to fix an accordion. The buttons get stuck. Because my ex-wife married her accompanist. She was an opera singer. It's a convenient marriage.
Yeah.
Next. No comment. Next.
I like that you skipped that one in between.
What one?
The one that you said no comment. You mentioned Lenny Bruce is one of your favorites. And it's interesting. I think Lenny's a guy who is kind of lost on my generation of comedians. I talked to other comics around my age, and they don't get Lenny Bruce. What was it about
Lenny
Bruce?
My son doesn't get him that much. It goes back to breaking ground. My son took a film course at the University of Vermont. He said, I'm excited. I'm going to see Citizen Kane. And I said, Ali, it's still one of the best films ever made. But remember, you have seen all these techniques have been copied. Mm-hmm. You know, so when Lenny Bruce used profanity, he got locked up, and he was doing what his work is relatively innocent compared to what you hear today. He was sort of the Christ crucified on the cross for doing it. Another thing is his references are dated. He died in 1966.
Yeah.
You know, and they took a picture of him with the needle in his arm next to his toilet, and it was in the papers. He couldn't work at the end of his life. He had a guy named Garber who was his lawyer. He had no champions. People were afraid to hire him because the cops came in. And he made a joke about the Pope in Chicago, and they locked him up right in front of the audience. So he was a pioneer. It was very hip in a jazz kind of way, and also in references from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, movies references. So that's why, I think. But he broke through the mold. Originally, he did impressions. He was a cufflink kind of guy.
Right.
And he became ultra hip and you know, like organized religion. He made fun of things. He used profanity in a way to say that this is just language. It's just, and of course, a few years later, George Carlin got arrested, was released immediately when the Milwaukee cops tried to pin it on him. Those days were over by the 70s. So
right.
He was a pioneer, and he took stand-up comedy in a new direction, a very hip direction. I mean, Mort Saul would carry a New York Times under his arm and come out and do a monologue. And a lot of it was witty, but he wasn't a performer. He wasn't a one-man show doing noises and voices like Lenny and like Pryor.
Lenny
and
had
like
all Jonathan. All the skill sets.
And Jonathan, too. Even Chris Rock, who was... you know, has wonderful ideas, and he's adorable, and he's getting old too. I think he's 50 or something. You know, it's sneaking up. But he doesn't, you know, he doesn't have that kind of, you know, he I don't know. He's a pretty, in these little comedies he does, he's pretty good. But he's not, he's a monologist, basically. He depends on strong material. And of course, he delivers it well. But I like a one-man show. I like that guy, someone who grabs the stage.
That's also maybe because you come from that acting background, too.
Who?
You. I mean, I'm not saying that's the only reason why.
No, I mean, at Yale, Miss Welch, the drama coach at the Yale Drama School, when I was there, oh, Klein, you ought to do a one-man show, Mr. Klein, you know. Mm-hmm. I was always kidding around and everything. I did both in my career a lot because I kept working, kept me working.
Right.
And also interested. You know, I'm going to do a movie now. Oh, I got this stand-up date here, so I never got tired. And also, I don't want to do Broadway anymore. You have to show up 8 times a week. I'm spoiled.
When you do stand-up, do you keep a sort of order to your set, or do you jump around?
Nah, I jump around. I can do it in my sleep.
Yeah.
I could, you know, be off for a while and go and do it. And I have so much material I've written because of my arrangement with all these years with HBO. I've done 9 of them. 2 of them were 90 minutes. That's a lot of material. And so, I mean, this stuff I haven't done for years. We have the luxury as writers of having a lot of stuff, you know. And my early days at the Improv set me off big time because the audience was, there were a lot of regulars at the Improv in the late 60s, early 70s. So I'd see the same faces. I had spent a year with Second City. I was a good improviser. Boom, boom, boom. I pulled up the truck, as Rodney used to say. Yeah, pull up the truck. You know, you write material, throw it in. And I do resent having my material stolen, but that is... Rodney, his material was stolen mercilessly, but...
Did he care?
Oh, very much. Yeah, very much. He has a funny story. Gabe Kaplan was a notorious joke thief. And, like in the Borscht Belt, a comedian I like, I worked with him, I won't mention who he is. Ah, fuck it. Stewie Stone, and I love Stewie. He produced a show at the Mohegan Sun, and he was on the bill, and I closed the show, you know. And I hear a couple of my jokes. I said, man, it was yours? Like, in other words, oh, I thought I took it from so-and-so, I took it from you. Robin Williams was known for that. You know, you can ask guys, but his was different. He was like a sponge, and then he'd apologize.
Yeah, you know, I think with Robin,
it just, you know, it was went into his head.
One thing I kept hearing, I went to this thing at the Comedy Store after he passed away, and a lot of his friends got up and talked, and they were saying how he never had a filter. And I thought about it. If you don't have a filter, you need a filter to make sure you don't repeat stuff you heard. I mean, if you're just sort of taking in and letting things out in a kind of a free flow way, you're going to run that risk.
Unfortunately, you know? In stand-up comedy, there are still are not standardized legal ways of protecting a material as easily as, say, Charles Dickens could protect his work in England in 1858.
Publish it. I guess that's
The best might have thing published on albums and HBO publishing. The point is that no one, you know.
You think people
there was a guy in Cruises who did my colonoscopy song that I wrote with Bob Stein that was nominated for a Primetime Emmy.
Yeah.
Maybe an Epi. And this guy's on a cruise ship claiming he wrote it and does it and sells a CD, among other things, doing that song.
So that bothers you?
Oh, no.
Really?
Cheap crumb bum is going to use my work and say he does it.
I would imagine you'd say, look, I'm Robert Klein. Who cares about this cruise ship guy?
No, not at all. I don't like that. You make up your own stuff. I saw one of my lines on the front page of the New York Times a few years ago. There was an article about the opening of squirrel hunting season in Louisiana. The Times will do this sometimes, a cultural thing. And it says, some people think squirrels are the so-and-so. Other people think squirrels are a rat with good public relations. That's my line.
That's a great line.
Yeah. So, Rodney hears Gabe do one of his jokes at the Improv. He says, I'll tell you, don't do my material, you know? Get your own. Don't do it, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, Rodney, all right. A few months later, he sees him doing some other line or whatever. And he figures he's going to make him think he's crazy and scare him. I'll tell you, I'm crazy, okay? And he's going right up to him, and he really scares him, you know? Mm-hmm. It's okay, Rodney, I won't do it. A few months later, he sees him doing one of his lines again. He says, didn't I tell you not to do my lines? He says, oh, you still don't want me to do it? Oh, you still don't want me to do it?
As if something had changed. That's great. How often do you write nowadays? Do you still...
Yeah.
Not so much?
I'm sitting down and writing. I really should write another book. I think my book is terrific, and it begs the question. Watch out for that water. It begs the question of, see, I had a child, so I know how to prevent accidents.
Okay.
What was the question?
You were about to beg it, but I don't know. You said it begs the question. You wrote a book, but it begs
the question. I should write another one. Every time I work, I'm improvising something else. I just don't foresee taking another couple of years and then putting together another HBO special.
Why? Why not?
Because, I don't know. It just doesn't seem worth it. It doesn't. What is exciting is that there is a documentary being done about me. Marshall Fine, the film critic, is directing it. Uh-huh. All my work is available. My life today up in Briarcliff, going to the hardware store, having little girls recognize me on the street. Oh, you're right. They Google me. You know, here I'm 72. They don't know that about the Tonight Show 80 times or Mike Douglas or David Letterman.
Do people really pull their iPhones out in front of you and Google you? Is that something that's
these
happened?
Little girls did because they recognized me from one of the romantic comedies. I had to lose a guy in 10 days, uh-huh. Huge movie. And 2 weeks notice with Sandra Bullock. But, I'm not actively, I never do a show without doing something new, you know. But I don't feel anxious about it. I love having fewer responsibilities. This Jerry Seinfeld thing I did, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. So many people have seen it generate such energy. I just don't have anything to prove anymore.
Is that what it was about?
What?
Proving something.
Always.
What were you always trying to prove?
That I'm doing pretty much as good as there is, as good as anybody doing it, you know. In my way. I mean, I made choices that were not populist. I just mean that as a performer, the public and the critics and everything people are gracious after all these years. They look at my face and smile. Years ago, that was tough. Like, a pretty girl would look at me and start laughing. You know, my fly open. But people are grateful. They say, thank you for all the laughs. A lot of them older, too, who have been watching me for all these years. But it's what have you done for me lately? I remember being on a plane with Eddie Murphy, who I actually, since I did it years ago, I really haven't watched much Saturday Night Live. And I know I've missed a lot of funny things. I don't know who most of these people are. I knew Eddie Murphy was a big movie star, and I'd seen him in some things, and he was very good. And we're on a plane together 20 years ago. I don't know. He said, man, I need a hit. You know? And I couldn't believe it. I went, you're a big movie star. What do you mean? Well, my last two didn't make money, blah, blah, blah. So it brings to mind Robin, too. I mean, Robin had another Mrs. Doubtfire was going to be done. Mm-hmm. He had a couple in the can, indies and all that. Said, hey, things are going great. No, comparatively. It's what have you done for me lately and new, you know? Like, what's new? What's new?
Yeah.
That's old. What's new?
Right.
And also because I must say, an achievement, not to sound immodest, but on two fronts, living in New York, having a show business career out of New York, and the other thing is having lasted this long and working where you get calls to
huge accomplishment.
Work, yeah, because it's a very youth-oriented business. I seldom go to a show. I went to the Sharknado party. I was the mayor of New York in that. I was the oldest at the party by 25, 30 years.
Maybe is that a tough feeling to be?
No, I'm getting quite used to it. But, you know, I read a lot of political stuff, the New Republic, the New York Times. I watch MSNBC. I'll even tune into Fox a little to get aggravated. But the point is, all of the wonks, all of these people talking, particularly on the progressive side, are young. They're young. And a lot of times they're really smart. And you see all these authorities on this and that, and you look, and I think to myself, boy, what a young woman, what a young man. But that's what the world is about. So it's an adjustment that you have to make. And show business makes the adjustment all the more stark. So I did routines about it, like playing the fathers of beautiful women, like Sandra Bullock and Kira Sedgwick and Jennifer Tilly.
I saw you do it live. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I talk about it. And also, there's an odd phenomenon. Are you about 31?
31. Yeah.
There's an odd phenomenon as you get older. Unless it's not like someone who hasn't seen you in a while, then they see you. They saw you in grade school. Now they see you now. Or I've seen people I knew I haven't seen for 40 years. They're gray haired and all that. It's when you're with yourself all the time, it's not as stark. You know, I mean, I if I were 16 and looked in the mirror and looked like I look, I would, you know, call Twilight Zone and get a show about it. It's just not, it's, I guess it's natural. And our society, our culture, in my opinion, is terrible in dealing with old age and death. Terrible.
Oh, terrible.
It's all bullshit, the golden years, and do this and that, and have your face stretched and all this, and not enough veneration for the elderly. I must say Medicare is an absolute miracle lifesaver. And these idiots that keep on arguing. If everyone had medical care in this country, we'd actually gain from it because they'd be healthy. They wouldn't be missing work. They would be, anyway, it's so stupid. But, you know, we discard old people. We put them in places, horror houses.
Yeah,
where they're taken advantage of. And where you see them, sure. If they have some money, they have some Latina who's getting minimum wage, wheeling them on Broadway.
Yeah,
it's
a sad thing.
We've relegated the care of our elderly to people who we underpay, and you know.
And it was. You brought up the story about Eddie Murphy on the plane and chasing the hit. Is that, are you saying that you're kind of rebelling against that in the way that you go about life?
I'm trying not to be caught up in that? It is a what have you done for me lately business. And so that part of the frame of mind in the middle of a competitive career when, you know, there are other comedians on the books of Gersh Agency and all that, and and who's current and who's hot and all that. There's always, you know, I would go into a venue sometimes and they'd say, oh, we had so-and-so last year or some singer or something and nobody liked them or they weren't cooperative or all this. I mean, I just go in and devastate the place always. I mean, my level is high. The worst show I ever do, if I'm sick or I'm not, will only be brilliant to them. Honestly, I'm to the point now. I told you I'm in excellent health. I am 72, which is hard to believe. But I've had a really interesting life. And what few regrets I have, I just really are not significant. I don't think what I could do to make it better, more interesting. I did what I was good at, which very few people get to do. It's extraordinarily competitive. Everyone wants to be in show business. It's fun, right? Doesn't look like real working. And the other thing is that when I started out, being a comedian was not a clear-cut profession. They were comedians, but now there's, you hear expressions, comedy community. Mm-hmm. You're in the comedy community, Dan. And you're in the comedy industry. You never heard expressions like comedy wasn't a thing. In fact, television killed nightclubs. And then television helped create a whole new a series of clubs.
Right.
And I was partly responsible because I did the first HBO ever. And then A&E at the Improv and all these other things and there were comedy clubs. And then there was a pancaking. What philosopher is it?
Well, the guy Alex picked is Rousseau for you. And I'll tell you why.
Rousseau's good.
You know about Rousseau?
I do. Frenchman and yes.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you were a substitute teacher. So he picked Rousseau because he's a philosopher of education. And like I said before, you've always had a very professorial air about you on stage.
Jean-Jacques Rousseau. June 1712 to July 1778 was a Genevan philosopher. Genevan? I thought he's French. Philosopher, writer, and composer of the 18th century. His political philosophy influenced the French Revolution, as well as the overall development of modern political, sociological, and educational thought. He teamed with Jerry Lewis briefly in 1941 and played Atlantic City. He did the philosophy and Jerry did the slapstick.
Sure, Rousseau and
Rousseau's
Lewis.
Novel, Émile, or On Education, is a treatise on the... I'm not. Oh, let's discuss him. I feel I know him like the back of my hand. Go ahead.
Well, I didn't get the rest of it, but...
Rousseau, I know this guy.
You do?
Yes, he was the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals. Rousseau, and he was an excellent philosopher. Went to law school.
Well, here's what our guy Alex said about him for you.
Okay.
He said, Rousseau plans an education system that would allow a, quote, natural man, selfish, to still function in society. Every society must denature man of his primal selfishness. Our natural desires, an example, hunger, exist for a reason, to keep us alive, which is kind of what we were talking about with drive in terms of, we were talking about doing comedy. And
well, what he's saying is you need rules.
Yeah, but he's also saying these natural desires that we have are there to keep us alive.
My father, for example, hated his work as a textile salesman. 65 on the nose. My mother was 64. They went to Florida. And, you know, I don't think he was ever the same because he had been busy, even if he hated it. And now his schedule, he had no schedule. And I don't know what it is with South Florida. Because I sent two healthy 65-year-old parents there 30 years later with debt. Do you know that George Shapiro said that got the biggest laugh in Seinfeld's documentary, Comedians? What I hear then is to curb the base nature of man. That's true. That's why these libertarians go too far. We have a complicated society. You need laws. You can't, you know, have food thrown out in the street and people fighting over it. You have to have a rule of law. Mm-hmm. You have to, if there's a queue waiting online for something, you can't have everyone just coming in and cutting the line. There's certain civility, holding the door it starts with, or saying thank you. And, you know, you're not allowed to go over to someone and punch them in the face or take a woman's clothes off. Or,
right.
You know, that's partly what Rousseau said. Now, let's hear the rest of it.
He says, he goes on to say, however, when we... overindulge them, we mistake natural appetite for greed. We must show man that his real desires are small and are in harmony with living at peace with others. His hunger doesn't mean he has to kill for it. Kind of like you were saying, you don't have to push these people off the line, you know?
Go ahead. His hunger doesn't mean he has to kill for it.
To teach this properly to children, Rousseau suggests toughening them up, making them deal properly with hunger, thirst, etc. Desires must be acknowledged but not overindulged. Our real natural state is to be at peace with each other because that clearly works best.
I'm sure kids would love that. Listen, I'm starving you tonight and no water. Rousseau, he said to toughen you up. So you're not getting anything to eat from 6 o'clock tonight. We'll pretend it's Yom Kippur. You're not getting anything to eat. Rousseau knows what he's talking about. You got to deal with thirst. You got to deal with hunger. But, Ma, there's Pepsi Cola right within my reach and a hot dog. I'm sorry. You must witness thirst and hunger.
Do you fast on Yom Kippur?
No. I slow on Yom Kippur.
Did you ever?
Yes, once, and I fainted.
Really?
Yeah, the year of my bar mitzvah, and I fell into a man's lap who was davening. An old man, and my head is in his lap. It looked like I was performing fellatio in this poor dude. And he was so into his prayer, he didn't realize there's a young man with his head in his lap. Wow. I was green. There was no air conditioning. It was an Indian summer, and I never fasted again. You know what? I do not work on Yom Kippur. I did in the Second City. I didn't realize it was Yom Kippur. The next morning, I had a tremendous puswort on my nose. That was God's warning. I just don't work on that day. I have no interest in going to synagogue. I don't care about the Talmud much. I'm proud to be Jewish, and I've talked about it all my life, all my career. Just the way Richard Pryor talked about being black. My father communicated to me how anti-Semitism played a part in his life. He was born in 1907 in New York. Whether it was bullying, you know, playing baseball in against some team of anti-Semites and fights, and or you know, traveling in upstate New York and being treated like an alien. And things have gotten so much better. But I experienced it at Alfred University, discrimination in the fraternities. Four of them were out of six were white Christian only. It was a terrible, painful thing. And I've talked about it a lot. And I just think it's remarkable that there are 13 million Jews in the world. It's an awful lot of Jews that are leaders and scientists. And I mean, there is something in the country. There are also a lot of dummies and poor people. And, you know, there's no way of making a generalization. But for the size of the Jewish population of the world and the fact that the population of Jews was cut in half in World War II, and you see horrors, not on the same scale, but being committed in 2014, genocide, it's disheartening. But that's one thing I despise in my life, anti-Semitism. It's completely irrational. What is it? You think all Jews are, everybody locks arms? I don't feel any kinship with these maniacs who are taking over the government and Rockland County with the Payists and all that, who are actually bullying other people in the neighborhood, just because they're Jews. But I mean, the idea of Jews as some source of evil is still a light in the world, big time, especially in the Middle East. And it's hard to fathom. And General Eisenhower, at the end of the war, here they saw all these bodies putrefying, and they realize it goes into the millions, children, women, everyone. And he made the local townspeople where the concentration camps were come, as Germans, mm-hmm. and look what's been done in your name. And he says, I want them to witness this because someday some son of a bitch is going to deny this happened. And of course, there are your Holocaust deniers all over
the place. They were probably the first ones to deny it. I saw nothing there.
Well, a lot of that, of course, mm-hmm. within the past century, I mean, all this happened. People are alive who it happened to. People are alive who perpetrated it to this day.
The fact that you don't work on Yom Kippur, is that just a showing of solidarity?
Yeah. It's absolutely. It says I'm a Jew, albeit a secular one. This is the holiday makes sense to me. Talk about philosophy. It's a cleansing. It's a evaluation of yourself vis-a-vis the world. Have you been a good citizen of humanity? It doesn't only extend to Jews. It at base, it's fantastic. It's self-searching, and you don't work for a day. People don't wash, they don't eat, they don't, you know.
I go the whole nine yards at the Yom Kippur.
Yeah, that's cool. A lot of people do.
A
lot of people do. I feel with perfectly good conscience. I can't even sit for a bar mitzvah anymore. I don't want to hear all the prayers. I'm not interested. Mm-hmm. All I care about is the person is ethical, and that Jews are not the only. I mean, the situation of Jews in America at the moment is the finest it's ever been. Jews have been in positions of power at all ends of the political spectrum. Jews have an odd ally in born-again Christians who think, oh, this is great. These Jews are taking care of Israel and they take care of the Christian sites.
They're happy to befriend us because they want to see us destroyed by an apocalypse.
They want to convert us. And I never realized what an insult that is until Len Garment, the late, who was a lawyer for Nixon, a very prominent American Jew, said to our friends at the Southern Baptist Convention, please remove the covenant that says, and of course, our Jewish friends, we hope to convert them, you know.
Yeah.
Horrible stuff in Europe. Horrible stuff. Sure. And not only.
In France.
From, I mean, the graffiti in metropolitan Paris along the freeways and everything is disgusting. The place is going to hell. But there's a lot of post-colonial population there from Africa, and they're Muslims, and tried teaching the Holocaust to them, even though France was a disgrace during the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And it looked the other way, like a lot of the Poles ratted on the Jews. The Poles were virulently anti-Semitic. But there's also this snooty intellectual anti, and they say, oh, it's only Israel. It's not the Jews. And that's a cover.
Sure, it's a mass.
It's a little sliver of a place the size of New Jersey. And what everyone forgets, they don't know their history, how they started with bicycles and shotguns, and why they have these territories, because they were attacked 3 times. Yeah. I do not agree with these racist, virulent right-wingers who feel that the Palestinians should be just thrown out of the place. But the truth is, the silly secret is, that the Palestinian Arabs who live in Israel are the freest in the Middle East in terms of picking a leader. Yes, they do not live in a Muslim country, but they can free to practice their religion. They live in a Jewish state, and that burns their ass. Well, I'm sorry. The Jews have no other place to go because every Arab country threw them out. You know, they left Europe in after the Holocaust. There were 2 million Jews in Poland. After the war, there were 15,000.
Sure, yeah.
And they still blame them. So,
it's ridiculous.
You know, we have a long way to go, and it's frightening what's happening in Europe in terms of that. And you know, to have synagogues bombed and all that. And
Where are you on prayer?
Prayer?
Do you ever pray?
No.
Never?
No, conveniently. If I get stuck in an elevator, I become religious. Oh, years ago in the fraternity when my girlfriend's period was late. You know, oh, God, help me. Oh, thank you.
Do you believe in God?
I guess somehow, but no. I believe that there is such an incredible... You know what? I'll go with Einstein. Instead of saying God, I think he used God. The more he cracked through these wonders of science, the more spiritual he became. Because it just blew his mind, this incredible stuff. And so it makes you feel spiritual. And you know. But Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did 600 interviews with dying people and found that atheists could have as comfortable a death as a believer. But a true believer like Bach, or you know, Billy Graham, or some, you know, anti-Semite. Look at him. He's still held up. He's still old. Yeah. He's still alive, this bastard. Talking with Nixon about those Jews. You know, disgusting.
All right. Well, let me go back to Rousseau.
No,
a little
don't
bit
go
more
back
on
to
him.
Rousseau.
Here's a quote from Rousseau. Everything is good as it leaves the hands of the author of things. Everything degenerates in the hands of man.
That's not a very optimistic thing. I mean, you know. And the author of things is God?
I assume so.
I don't know.
It's certainly an environmentalist argument, you know, how man kind of destroys the planet.
I don't believe that even if what God creates or whatever. Oh, if it means you could say metaphorically a baby is innocent, but one of these moronic congressmen from the South trying to stop abortion said, we have seen at 15 weeks a little male fetus is pleasuring himself. So what's innocent about that? Jerking off at 15 weeks.
Here's another one. The best social institutions are those that best know how to denature man, to take his absolute existence from him in order to give him a relative one and transport the one into the common unity.
I don't know, doing things together, it takes a community, it takes a village. Nobody can live completely by themselves. People need people. Next. People, People who need people. All the Russo is people in the world. Russo, Russo, Russo. Next.
Here's the last quote from Russo.
No, I never nap.
By the way, do you agree that you need a lot of people around? Because going out to Westchester, it kind of feels like there's some resistance to that.
To what?
To having people around all the time. Or do you still do that?
No, I would like to have more people around, I think.
So you do really think it's important to surround yourself, not to be a recluse?
Not to surround myself, but to keep up friendships, to go out, to see people, to have lunches, to have dinners, to have sex. I would like a dog, but I don't want to be burdened.
After being through such a tough divorce, does it make you jaded about love?
No. I think unconsciously, it definitely, like getting your finger burned or actually third-degree burns over 80% of your body. It was very sad. It was a terrible experience. And I haven't been married since, so I would get married. But I have actually been in love since. Love is a fantastic feeling. I've been in love, I would say, four genuine times with four different women in my life. And it's an incomparable feeling, like the birth of my son or seeing him blossom into a terrific man. It's incomprehensibly divine, but hard to acquire, can't be faked.
Do you still believe in marriage as an institution?
Absolutely. Not for me, but I'm too set in my ways. I mean, a woman, I have pictures of the Marx Brothers all over my house. I have tons of pictures I have to put up here of my career and all that. Somebody might want to do frouzy curtains. I don't know. I am set in my ways pretty much, but female company, and I had a significant relationship. I know this woman 10 years. We actually had three or four really good years. Grown children kind of thing, living close by up there in Brooklyn. And it was great. And it's not there anymore. And, I either way, the idea is if I die without a mate, that doesn't bother me. I just, the idea is to enjoy and produce, which is part of enjoying. And a lot of it is pure luck. Staying healthy, One day you just, Joan Rivers is, selling her bracelets, and the next day she's dead. So when you get older, your chances of dying increase, as you know. And my brother-in-law is 94 years old, and he plays golf. He doesn't walk with a cane. He drives. He's fortunate. Not everybody's like that. I have contemporaries of mine that are a mess, and they didn't have sex, drugs, and rock and roll like I did, Show business, they're judges and doctors, and they look old, they think old, and they're old, And a lot of it is mental. A lot of it is mental, and use it or lose it kind of thing, When I'm in the city, I walk miles, and I work out on a treadmill up there. I do some running, light running. Use my mind. Anyway, pot is excellent practice for dementia, don't you think?
What have been the most important things in life? What do you think?
My career is very important. It turned out great, but that was a lot of luck too. I mean, I have talent, but being at the right place at the right time, a little good fortune, a little intelligence. Career is important. My son is very important to me. I'm sorry the marriage didn't work out. I was married technically 16 years.
Do you ever miss her?
Not her, no. I miss a couple of others. No, I don't miss her, no. I don't have anything to do with her, really. I mean, if I have to talk to her, it's not that I won't talk to her, but I thought she was unforgivably really stupid, because it was all her money, too. I just split it right down the middle and spent hundreds of thousands on lawyers, because she was looking for some revenge, and the lawyer was happy to issue all the paper. Yeah, it was terrible. I got two ulcers.
Can you still go back to remembering what it was that you loved about her before
Absolutely.
All
that?
And is it
some of the happiest times of my life, being married to her early on. We had a little vacation house up in Croton. We had a big adopted German shepherd. She sang in the opera. She sang in the Metropolitan Opera. There were many, many good times.
And those times still stay with you even after all the ugly divorce stuff?
Only when I look at a picture here and there, and I think mostly my child is a little boy. The time after we were divorced was not a happy time to have to leave him, mostly with her. I would see him weekends. I would see him eventually more and more until finally he moved in with me. So.
All right, last quote, and that's the end of the show.
No more quotes from Russo.
It's the last
one.
No. It's quick.
No, well, it's useless because I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
Give it a shot, and if you don't like it, we won't talk about it. Nature never deceives us. It is always we who deceive ourselves.
Well, nature isn't a thinking entity. Nature is nature. We can anthropomorphize it with expressions like it's cruel. You turn on one of these nature shows on Smithsonian and you see lions ripping a zebra apart or tigers eating the young of some hoofed animal. It's rough. And so it isn't anything. We say Mother Nature, but it has no thought process. It is what it is. And so that's very true. Any deception is us in our own mind. There isn't an entity to deceive us. We deceive ourselves. You know, that Rousseau might have something there.
Do you have
the classic comic of him?
He won you on the last one, maybe.
Remember classic comics? Do they still have them?
I know them, yeah, but I don't think they still make them.
You're supposed to read Daniel Defoe's Last of the Mohegans, and you'd read the classic comic instead.
Well, I appreciate you doing this, and I appreciate you taking the time. I do.
Lobel, I wish I could say it was my pleasure, but you know what? I can say it was my pleasure. You're a nice man, and you have a lot of balls coming in here quoting Rousseau.
Thanks.
I thought Rousseau's was a restaurant. Ain't that?
Everybody, thank you so much for tuning into the show. Thank you again to Robert Klein. It's been a great season. I can't wait to come back with season 5. Next week is the wrap-up show with Alex Fasella, who I am always very indebted to for this show, for all the wonderful work he does behind the scenes, putting together the philosophers and coming up with great things for us to talk about. And, of course, I want to thank Logan Heftel once again this season. He has been with me since the beginning, mastering the audio, and we appreciate it very, very much. I do, and I know so many of you do as well. Logan Heftel's music is up on SoundCloud, and I'm often retweeting it, or I don't think it's called tweeting on SoundCloud, but I share it on my SoundCloud page, which is soundcloud.com/Danny-Lobel, where I also have all the Modern Day Philosophers episodes up, if you want to check that out. My email address is thecomical@yahoo.com. Shoot me an email. Say hello. Let me know what you thought of the season. I would love to hear from you. Again, if you want to make a donation, go to moderndayphilosophers.net. And if you have any time and you want to help the show out, it doesn't cost anything to go on iTunes and leave 5 stars and a nice review. And it's very, very, very appreciated. Okay, everybody. Thank you again. And have a wonderful, wonderful week. Talk to you on the wrap-up show. Goodbye.